GFL Book 6. Oh, oh, did that get your attention? Hey, you want to save 15 smackers on GFL Book 6? Episode 2 of Alive is brought to you by our Galactic Football League Book 6 pre-order discount. How can you get that, you ask? Well, you pre-order hardcover copies of Alive. Email us the receipt before July 14th, 2015, and we will send you unique coupon codes to save 15 bucks on GFL Book 6. Good for up to 5 copies. But wait, you say, what's the catch? You ask, there is no catch. $15 off per book, up to 5 books. Just like that. Listen in after the intro music for the details, yo. And now, on with our story. Welcome to the serial audiobook Alive, an unabridged podcast of Book 1 in the Generations Trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Performed by Emma Galvin. This novel is available in print, ebook, or as a full-length audiobook. For links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Audible, please visit scottsigler.com/alive. Hello, junkies! Just 3 weeks from Alive hitting bookstores on July 14th, 2015. Yes, I have been banging away on hardcover pre-orders, and I'm about to bang again. This book, having a huge first week, would be epic and awesome and important for Siglerism. Why? Because a great first week proves we're good partners to Del Rey, who have been great partners to us. They are publishing Alive. Also, and this is where it matters to you guys, a great first week looks great to folks who make movies and TV and could get us closer to a Sigler movie. If you remember, Nocturnal and Infected are being pitched right now as TV series. A great first week for Alive gets serious attention in Hollywood, and that improves our chances of landing Nocturnal and Infected as a series or Alive as a feature film, because it's being pitched as that right now. So, to help us launch Alive and to kind of, you know, pay it forward for our future careers and entertainment company, we decided to put our money where our mouths are. Also, there's another reason for this. We're not deaf. We're not blind. Some of you have shown your unhappiness that I'm doing what they are marketing, a young adult novel. Okay. We get that. But some of you who've been with us for a while, you go back far enough to remember when I podcast The Rookie for the first time, and you were all like, football and sci-fi, bro, I don't even like football. And I asked you to give me 4 episodes before we made up your mind. Remember that? And sucker, most of you who took me up on that were hooked. And you people have bought all of the GFL series, so I am asking you to not only trust me, but I'm putting my money where my mouth is. To get you to try Alive, we are dangling one hell of a carrot. Pre-order Alive, then email us the receipt. That can be either the receipt that Amazon or Barnes & Noble emails you, or you can scan a receipt from an actual bookstore where you go in person. Send that to info@emptyset.com before July 14th, 2015, and we will give you a code good for $15 off GFL Book 6 when it goes on pre-order sometime in 2016. But wait, you say, Alive is only 14 bucks at Amazon and 18 bucks at most of your local bookstores. That's right. What does that mean? If you like those limited edition, tricked out GFL hardcovers, most of which are sold out, you're going to get Alive for free or real close to it. We think you are going to love this series. There's 2 more books in the series, so I'll take all of your monies farther on down the road. The only exception to this is if you are coming to see me on tour. Tour dates are listed at scottsigler.com/tour or scottsigler.com/alive, where we also have the trailer up. Yes, if you buy the hardcover while we are on tour at one of the tour bookstores, that is going to count. Other than that, your receipt must be dated before July 14th, and you're going to email that to info@emptyset.com. But if you're coming on tour, if you're going to come see us on tour and throw down with us, not only at the tour, but at the after parties that follow every tour, those are going to count as well. We will give you a code on site. If we're not coming to your city or you can't make it to the tour, yes, Amazon.com works just fine. And again, this contest is for hardcover only. Only hardcover. You get me? You can order those hardcovers from Amazon. Remember, up to 5, no problem. But consider pre-ordering from your local Barnes & Noble or going into or calling your local indie bookstore. They need the business too. They will be able to sell you alive and they will be very happy that you called.
But Scott, I already pre-ordered.
No problem. Get that receipt and email it to info@emptyset.com and you will get a coupon code too. The last thing you're probably asking is, can I really get $15 off per copy on up to 5 copies of GFL Book 6? Yes. Yes, you can. You just have to buy up to 5 copies of Live, send us those receipts, and you get those $15 off. It is a one-for-one match. Each copy of Live equals $15 off each copy of GFL Book 6, up to 5 copies max. So just to recap before we get into our story, pre-order hardcover copies of Alive. Then send either the email confirmation or a scanned receipt to info@emptyset.com. Proof of the pre-order must be dated before July 14th. We will send you unique discount codes good for $15 off GFL Book 6.
What excuse you got now, sir or ma'am?
Oh, I don't know if I like YA from Sigler.
Didn't I tell you the rookie would be good?
Yeah, well, you did, but I don't know about this. This could be different.
You got no excuse, because you're going to get the book basically for free when you get your GFL Book 6.
That's it, people. If you got any questions, email those as well to info@emptyset.com. Once you have read Alive, you will understand the reason they put the YA tag on a Sigler book. You will realize that that was ridiculous, and you will not be disappointed. Alive is balls-to-the-wall storytelling. Trust me, you are going to love it. I'll chat a little bit more about this contest, the whole YA thing, after the episode. But for now, ladies and gentlemen, junkies of all ages, here we go with Alive, episode number 2.
Four. The red-haired girl squints tightly, making the bridge of her nose wrinkle. So much hair, still draped over her face as if it can shield her from our strange reality. She's trying hard to make her watering eyes adjust. She trembles in my arms, terrified and confused. We're safe, I say, trying to comfort her. We're alone here. Take it easy. She nods, holds me tighter. But I feel her relax a little. Her hand seeks out mine, and we lock fingers. I look at our clasped hands. Our skin is not the same. Hers is pale, a pinkish tan. Mine is much darker. Mine is brown. Our hands are about the same size. That strikes me as strange. She looks older than I do, almost old enough to leave school. Girls that age are usually so much taller. School. These clothes. Did we wear things like this in school? I can't remember. I have a vague image of a few girls looking beautiful and perfect, while I looked ugly and stupid, even though we all wore the exact same thing. Her short plaid skirt shows almost all of her legs. They are long and shapely, not the knobby-kneed twigs of an awkward girl. Maybe someday I will have legs like hers. The sleeves of her white shirt end just past her elbows. At her chest, the top two buttons are missing, showing the curve of her breasts. She's probably embarrassed by that. I'm embarrassed for her. It makes me uncomfortable. We lie there, unmoving, dust motes swirling in the air. Her hair is so long. I reach to my own head, feel that my hair is tied back in a heavy braid. I pull it around and look at it. It's black and thick. The braid hangs down to my waist. It feels so silky, like it was recently brushed. Someone put me in a coffin and fixed my hair? A shiver slides across my skin. Maybe it's okay. Maybe Mom brushed it. Or Dad. But if it was them, did they do that right before they sealed me in and left me to die? The red-haired girl finally opens her eyes a little, blinking slits that show me their color. A deep green. She blinks away tears. She sniffs, wipes at her nose. "You saved me," she says. "You set me free." "Thank you, Em." She sits up. She brushes her thick hair behind her left ear, then her right. When she does, I see something on her forehead. A black circle, as wide as the distance between her eyes, made of a material that clearly isn't her, and yet is also a part of her at the same time. The dark color stands in stark contrast against her white-pink skin. The outside of the circle is smooth. The inside is kind of jagged, with stubby points sticking inward. 8 of them, evenly spaced apart. Stubby points. Kind of like teeth. She's a tooth girl. I feel a surge of emotions. Tooth girls. They made fun of me in school, didn't they? I can't remember my school, and I can't remember why the tooth girls ridiculed me. Only how their words and glares and jokes made me feel. Small, unimportant, worthless. I hate her. No, I don't even know this girl. At least I don't think I do. We're in this together. I will not hate her because of some decoration on her skin. Wait, do I have one? My free hand flies to my forehead. I feel something embedded there. A circle like hers, but smooth, both inside and out. There are no stubby points, no teeth. Our fingers remain locked. Her skin is warm, the only warm thing in this cold room. "I'm afraid," she says. "Em, what is this place?" "I don't know." My fingertips lightly trace the shape that marks her skin. She sees me doing that, reaches to her forehead. Her eyes widen with discovery. "I have one too," she says. "Yours is a plain circle, but mine feels different on the inside. Bumps or something. What are they?" "Teeth," I want to say. "Because you're a tooth girl." But I don't say that. I like her, and she seems to like me. I don't want her to know that word in case it makes her remember something and not like me anymore. "They look like stubby bits," I say. She waits for me to keep going, but I don't know any other way to describe what I see. She thinks for a moment. She shrugs. "We both have symbols. I don't know what they mean." "Neither do I." She looks around the room, taking it all in. "This isn't the birthday I was hoping for," she says. "It's your birthday too?" She looks at me doubtful, like I'm playing some kind of trick on her. "Yes," she says. "I'm 12. She's the one who was playing tricks. My instincts were right. The tooth girl, whatever that is, already making fun of me. I lean away from her. "I'm not dumb, you know," I say. She blinks, confused. Of course you're not. I didn't say you were." She blushes and looks away, like she knows she said something wrong but doesn't know what that something was. "Em, I would never be rude to my elders like that." "Elders? What is she talking about?" "You're not 12, I say. I point at her legs, her breasts. "Look at you. You think I'd be so stupid that I'd believe you're the same age as me?" Her expression of embarrassed confusion changes to one of total disbelief. She holds out her arms, looks at them, then down at herself. "I don't understand," she says. She pulls at the bottom of her shirt, but the material doesn't stretch. Her belly, flat, pale, is exposed. This, too, makes me uncomfortable. My belly is cold. I look down at my blood-speckled shirt and realize, for the first time, that it's too small for me. The bottom of it leaves my stomach open to the cold air. My sleeves end halfway up my forearms. No wonder it feels freezing in here. I'm half naked. I touch my belly, suddenly self-conscious. This seems wrong, like showing bare skin is a bad thing. The shirt is too tight against my breasts. Or are my breasts too big for my shirt? I feel them. They weren't this size before. Were they? No, they weren't. I'm sure of it. I can't remember anything, but I know my body has changed. The red-haired girl stares at me intensely. I realize I'm touching myself right in front of her. I look away, put my hands in my lap. She feels her own chest. Her eyes widen with surprise. What happened? They weren't like this before. I shake my head. Same with me. So, you say you're 12? She says. You look 19, maybe 20. You look like a grown woman. So do you. She nods slightly. She looks off, glancing at nothing in particular. Her lips twitch, like she's saying half words that I can't hear. It doesn't make sense, she says finally. We need more information. Until then, we have to believe what our eyes show us. She again cups her breasts. She isn't ashamed at all. She's measuring, thinking. The corners of her mouth curve up in a small grin. I can't recall what I asked for, but I'm pretty sure I wasn't expecting these as a present, she says. Maybe it's a good birthday after all. I mean, other than being locked up in the dark. Her fascination and delight with her body's unexpected change hasn't completely taken the fear out of her eyes. She reaches up, touches one of the carvings on her coffin lid. A jaguar, I think it is. One eye smashed and splintered from where I hit it. Some of these images seem familiar, she says. I can't place them, but, well, they're familiar. My coffin has them too. The red-haired girl wrinkles her nose, shakes her head. Coffins are for dead people, Em. We're clearly not dead. She stares at my forehead, her eyes narrow. She's trying to work something out. Then she looks away. Does she remember what my circle means? If so, she doesn't share. She points to the jewel-encrusted rod lying on the ground beside me. I think I know what that is, she says. I pick it up and wipe dust off the metal. I move it closer to her so she can see it better. Maybe you used a weapon like this before? For the first time, the red-haired girl smiles wide. It lights up her whole face. She looks amazing. Her eyes gleam with delight. I'm not sure it's possible for a person to be more beautiful than she is right now. It's not a weapon, she says. I think it's a tool. A tool? That never crossed my mind. She starts to nod, like she's sure she's right, then stops. Her smile fades. She's not sure. She isn't sure about anything. Em, do you know my name? No. Let's find out what it is. I stand, take her hand and help her up. She seemed so tall at first, but I'm only a tiny bit shorter than she is. I lead her to the front of her coffin. Just like with mine, there is a flat area surrounded by dust-covered jewels. I brush it clean. Blue jewels frame the engraved letters, T. Spingate. That's you, I say. I think. Your name is Spingate. Does that make you remember anything? She frowns. Her lower lip quivers. Her eyes water. And this time, it's not from the light. Her eyelashes are long and dark. I suddenly have a desperate urge to find a mirror. Do I have green eyes like hers? Spingate shakes her head. I can't remember anything. I remember my mom, sort of, but I can't remember her face. As soon as she says that, I realize I have no idea what my parents actually look like. Mom and Dad, they're blank spaces. I know the concept of my parents. I know they loved me and I loved them. But their faces? Their names? Nothing. Spingate sniffs, wipes away tears. She nods slowly, as if accepting things for what they are. She studies our surroundings, taking in the walls, the ceiling, the door arch. Em, do you know what's outside this room? No idea. She looks at the coffin across the aisle, where I found the weapon. That lid isn't shut all the way. Was that one yours? I point to my right, to the last coffin in our row. I see my path of footsteps through the dust. I was in that one, I say. Spingate stares down the aisle for a few moments. Her mouth moves a little again. When she does that, it's like she doesn't even know I'm there. She looks me up and down. How did you get all bloody? Other than smears of dust, her shirt is clean and white. There was a tube in my coffin, I say. It stabbed me with a needle. That's what woke me up. Her expression darkens. Maybe she realizes that if I hadn't broken out of my coffin, she would still be in hers. Em, how did you get out? There's no one else here. I shrug. I got myself out. She gives me a strange look, as if the concept is unthinkable. Spingate's hands reach to her shoulders, rub slowly up and down like she's hugging herself against the chill. She walks across the aisle, wobbling a bit, but standing on her own, then kneels at the foot of the coffin with the slightly open lid. She brushes off the nameplate. It says, B. Brewer. The stones are purple. Maybe we can use the tool to open it and see if someone is inside? We've been sitting here talking, and I never thought that there might be others trapped like Spingate was, like I was. All these coffins. Maybe one of them holds a person who knows what this place is and how we got here. I walk across the aisle and jam the heavy bar's forked end into the small crack. The lid closest to me under the bar, the forked end under the lid farthest away. I push down. The lid doesn't budge. I rise to my toes, pull all my weight on the bar. Em, I can help with... I've got it, I say, my effort turning the words into grunts. I hear a slow creaking coming from the lid. I rise up a little more, then push down as hard as I can, all at once. There is a loud bang from the coffin as something gives way. The lid halves suddenly tilt up, hum as they slide to the sides. Sheets of gray spill off their smooth, carved surfaces. We look inside. A wave of fear pushes my body a step backward. Spingate reacts differently. Instead of stepping away, she leans forward. Maybe you were right, she says. If that's B. Brewer, I guess in his case, it really is a coffin.
5. B. Brewer is a dead little boy. A thin line of dust runs up his tiny shriveled body, dust that fell through the crack between the lids. The coffin is the same size as mine and Spingate's, but it looks huge surrounding such a small corpse. The skin of his face is dried so tightly to his skull that it's cracked in some places, showing the bone beneath. His eyes are empty sockets. His lips have shrunken back, showing two rows of discolored teeth. It looks like he's smiling. I feel sick to my stomach. Brewer is wearing a white shirt and an embroidered red tie, black pants and a black belt instead of a plaid skirt. Even if he wasn't all dried up, the outfit would have been too big and too long for his little body. Pitted, crimson-spotted bars hold down his hips, ankles, and hands, even though his feet and wrists are hidden inside his pants and sleeves. Spingate points to his tiny forehead, to a symbol, just as black as ours, embedded in his dried skin. It is a circle with one line down the middle and one running from side to side. A cross, she says. Or a T. She shrugs. Maybe a plus sign? Maybe. A tooth girl. A circle girl, a cross boy, and we have no idea what any of it means. I'm staring at a corpse. That could have been me. These are coffins after all, so why is he dead while I am alive? Looking at him makes me cold in a different way than the temperature and my scant excuse for clothing. I'd be so much warmer with pants. Did he get to wear pants because he's a boy? If so, that's not fair. Spingate slowly extends a finger toward Brewer. She pokes his cheek. Dried flesh crumbles and falls away. It's awful, but it doesn't seem to bother Spingate at all. She grabs the sleeve of his shirt, starts to tug. My hand locks on her forearm. "Stop that," I say. "What are you doing?" "Making a bandage." "For what?" She points to my wrists. "You're still bleeding." I look at them and see she's right. The bars rubbed my skin raw. Small spots of red well up from a dozen tiny tears. Dust packs the wounds, making the blood more sludge than liquid, but it's still slowly oozing out. "I'm fine," I say. "We shouldn't disturb the dead." Spingate huffs. "The dead don't care." She tears two long strips from his shirt, jerking his tiny body in the process. A thick, dry piece of his face falls away, exposing the cheekbone below. Spingate wraps the strips around my wrists and ties them off. "That's better," she says. "Should we open the other coffins?" 9 remain closed. Spingate and I wasted time sitting with each other, a little more staring at Brewer. "Yes," I say, "and quickly." She holds out her hand toward my weapon. "Can I try?" That strikes me as funny. She wasn't strong enough to get out of her own coffin, but she thinks she's strong enough to break one open from the outside? I hand her the jeweled rod. Spingate takes it, and when she does, that soul-melting smile peeks out again. She's excited, moving quickly, her fear suddenly forgotten. She moves to the next coffin and brushes dust off the nameplate. The jewels sparkle bright yellow. "Kay O'Malley," she says. Spingate's fingers trace the yellow jewels. She puts a fingertip on one and pushes. It slides inward until it clicks. When she pulls her finger away, the jewel stays depressed. She pushes it again and it clicks again, then returns to its original height. She moves to the next one, pinches it between finger and thumb and twists. The jewel rotates in place. Somewhere inside the coffin, we hear a series of small whirs and clinks. Spingate doesn't know what she's doing, but she's trying things, pressing, then listening, turning, then listening some more. Her lips move a little, making no sound. She points at the jewels, her finger bouncing in the air. She's counting. She lifts the weapon, touches a pattern of jewels on its shaft, then presses a similar pattern on the jewels surrounding the name Kay O'Malley. A hidden panel on the side of the coffin slides up fast, revealing the negative space of two small circles. Spingate laughs, delighted at her success. She stands, then slides the rod's prongs into the circles. They fit perfectly. I hear a click. She lifts the end of the rod. A deep thrum comes from inside the coffin. The lid halves shudder. Dust powders down from them as they slide neatly to the sides. Inside, lying motionless, eyes closed, is a boy. A sleeping boy, dressed like Brewer, but as big as we are. Bigger, even. His shoulders press against the coffin's white fabric. The toes of his black-socked feet touch the end. He has thick brown hair. His skin is darker than Spingate's, but not as dark as mine. He is beautiful. The symbol on his forehead is a circle like mine, but the right half is solid black. His clean white shirt is far too small for his smooth chest. Some of the buttons are missing. There is no dust on him. None at all. No blood either. The bars holding his waist, wrists, and ankles seem far too tight. I stare at him. I can't help it. I feel strange. My insides shiver. "He's breathing," Spingate says, her words a hushed breath. "He's alive." I need this boy to wake up. I need him to see me. "Give me the weapon. I mean the tool. I'll break his bars." "Just a moment," she says. "We might not have to break anything." The tool is still firmly locked in the coffin's side, sticking up at an angle. She looks at it, then at O'Malley, then at the tool again. She presses a pair of jewels on the handle. Nothing happens. She thinks, presses a different pair, then Then the bars across O'Malley's wrists, ankles, and waist split in the middle and snap down, vanishing inside the coffin's padded lining. Other than the gentle rise and fall of his chest, he doesn't move. I feel a rush of panic that Spingate will wake him. I need to be the one who does it. Go open the other coffins, I tell her. She looks at me. She seems confused. She looks at O'Malley again. Spingate, hurry up about it, I say. We don't know how much time we have. She sighs. She likes looking at him too, and it's hard for her to look away. She does, though. She pulls the tool free and walks to the next coffin. I stare down at O'Malley. His hair looks so soft. His mouth is slightly open, his full lips moving with each breath. When Spingate smiled for the first time, I thought she was the most beautiful thing that could ever be. I was wrong. I hear Spingate brush dust away from a metal plate. This one is... Oh, I'm not sure, she says. I think it's... Aramovsky? Something about that grabs my attention. What are the last few letters? It ends with an S, a K, and a Y, she says. My breath catches, because I remember something. A name. A name of a... Oh, what is it? It's right there, tickling my thoughts. Of a musician. Yes, a musician with a name that ended in an S, a K, and a Y. Tchaikovsky. It's not sky, I say. It's ski. I go back to staring at O'Malley. Aramovsky, Spingate says. Can I open it? Why does she keep asking for my permission? Sure, go ahead. I hear her working at something. I reach out a finger, gently touch O'Malley's ribs. He's warm. The contact sends a prickling sensation across my skin. I don't feel cold anymore. He doesn't respond. What should I do? What if he doesn't wake up at all? I hear that thrum again. Hear Spingate laugh as Aramovsky's coffin opens.
That was a live episode number 2. I think you guys are enjoying this. I hope you're enjoying it. We're getting a lot of positive feedback on Facebook and on Twitter, all over the interwebs. To go back into this why thing, we have a lot of existing fans who have been with me for a long time, have bought all my books, and I love you guys. You're all awesome. But people have sort of dug in their heels about Alive because, although you like my old stuff that had lots of cursing in adult situations and lots of violence, the GFL was, that part of the GFL was toned down a bit, although it's an incredibly dangerous, violent series. Awful things happen to good people. People thought when I watered down, quote unquote, watered down the GFL series that they weren't going to like it. And you know what? Everybody found out they were wrong. It might be nice to have a little bit more of the John Tweedy spice in there, but overall, I think that the series has delivered. I think it's been satisfying. I think you have seen that it is just an adult story as it was when I first ran The Rookie, and that really the only difference is there's no curse words. That's the only difference. Alive is very, very similar to that. We are talking about, it's a brutal, brutal story. What these characters go through is an absolute ordeal, and it is traumatic, spiritually, physically, emotionally. I'm not going to lie, it was kind of a hard book to write because they go through so much by the time they get to the end, the ones that make it to the end anyways, that the only difference between this being quote-unquote YA and this being an adult book is there's no cursing. That's the only difference. And if you actually read the book or listen to the book, either way, you're going to see that that is in the milieu of the book, to borrow a phrase from the entertainment world. It's in the context. It's not a perfunctory thing that's done to sell books. It's part and parcel of the fabric of the story itself. But you guys will either buy it and figure that out for yourself, or you won't, and that's cool too. If you are still listening, though, that does mean you love yourself some Sigler. And you know I love you right back. And I'm happy to give you $15 off GFL Book 6 if you try a hardcover of Alive. That is how much that A Real Girl and I love you. Now, if money is tight and you're going to buy a GFL Book 6 anyway, Alive is pretty much free. In fact, if you buy it on Amazon, you walk away with $1.50, not counting shipping. We can't do anything with shipping. That ain't our business. But it's still 15 bucks off GFL Book 6, which you're going to buy anyway. If money is not tight, this is where we need you guys to support this free podcast. So pre-order Alive, and both you money tight, money not tight, pre-order, get that receipt emailed to info@emptyset.com. We'll send you a unique code that can only be used one time, and you will use that to save $15 off GFL Book 6 per copy, up to 5 copies. And also, I would gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. Is Popeye still a thing? I don't know. There's no more Saturday morning cartoons. Hold on. I'm going to step out of the recording booth and ask A Real Girl. Hold on. Is Popeye still a thing?
Popeye's always a thing.
A Real Girl says Popeye's always a thing. So Popeye's a thing, olive oil, Brutus, and of course, Wimpy, who is just a crazy crack fiend for those hamburgers. Those must be some darn good hamburgers. Between hamburgers and spinach, why don't they just put spinach on the hamburgers? Spinach hamburgers, and then Popeye and Wimpy could like roid out together. They'd all be like getting, I'm getting all swole, bro. And they would go out and bust up Brutus. But then if Brutus had a hamburger with spinach on it, then he would be just as, he'd still be bigger than those guys, but then he would be spinach superpowered too. Then he would whoop up on them. And let's be honest, olive oil, she could use a hamburger or two. Girl's got some, she's a little bit too skinny. Gotta put some meat on those bones. That's it for this week. Take advantage of this opportunity to buy Alive in hardcover and basically get a lovely, well-packaged book for free if you're going to buy GFL Book 6. And if you've never bought a GFL hardcover, you guys, these things sell out pretty quick. And once they are gone and out of print, they are out of print forever. And then you have to go pay like $300-$400 to buy them on Amazon or on eBay. And that does it for this week. We will be back next week with the live episode number 3. And until then, I will talk to you all real soon. You have been listening to Alive, Book 1 in the Generations Trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler, performed by Emma Galvin. Produced by Adrian Galvin and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. Follow Scott on Twitter and Instagram, where his handle is @ScottSigler. ScottSigler, one word, or join our Facebook group at facebook.com/ScottSigler. Theme music is the song Unseen Horrors by Kevin MacLeod.